Most Americans speak English, but are we really talking to each other?
I would describe this moment as one defined by ideological fracture that can be lethal if we are not careful enough, is the alternative vocabularies that the left and the right use to describe what is happening right now. It is the same English language. We are brought together by this American English in this country of 330 million people. But at the same time, it is an American English that has been segmented, cut apart by very different lexicons that we use to describe each other, the favorite words of these different groups, that I hate the term weaponized, but weaponizes that lexicon in order to describe the other as alien, as suspicious, as undermining of our own reality. And thus a word for one group like immigrant can feel empathetic, and another one, and for the other group, can feel threatening.
That's Elon Stavins. We talk with him about his fascinating anthology of writings in American English, from the colonists at Plymouth Rock to hip-hop in the era of Black Lives Matter. It's called The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language. We spend the hour with Stavins today on Writer's Voice, where you get in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Did you know that American English, not British English, is one of the very few languages that has no dialects? No matter where you're from in this big country, you can easily understand the speech of anyone else. That's true even with having different regional accents or ethnic differences such as Black English. That's one of the many fascinating things I learned from reading Elon Stavins' anthology of writings in American English, spanning 450 years of our history as a nation. His introduction and comments alone are worth the price of the book, but it also contains a wealth of literature and thinking on our language that's truly remarkable. It features a wide array of letters, poems, memoirs, stories, songs, documents, and essays from Sojourner Truth and Abraham Lincoln to Henry Roth and Zora Neale Hurston, from George Carlin and James Baldwin to Louise Erdrich and hip-hop artist Kendrick Lamar, all elucidating the breadth and depth of this freewheeling, eclectic, ever-changing, immigrant-forged, magnificent language of ours. Elon Stavins is an immigrant himself, and as such, he has a deep understanding of how the immigrant experience has shaped American English, giving it a richness and elasticity that few other languages can rival. But he also notes the depth it owes to the indigenous peoples of this continent, whose stamp on the land is most obvious in the numerous place names that remind us of their presence and the settlers' theft of their territory. Stavins is professor of humanities, Latin American, and Latino culture at Amherst College. Elon Stavins, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You grew up a polyglot, knowing a number of different languages, and you are an immigrant, came here. You have clearly learned English to a T. You write so beautifully. Can you tell us about your own personal connection to language and how it influenced your decision to do this anthology?
My personal connection to language, Francesca, I think it's the question of a lifetime, and probably would take a lifetime also to answer. For me, language is everything. It is in the way I dream, in the way I engage with the world, the way the world itself is built in blocks of words, of sounds. It is the way I dress and people dress. In other words, it's both appearance and the channel to the soul. And I am always attuned and aware of the fact that there is not one language for any of us. There are multiple languages, which means that we exist in multiple universes simultaneously. And that not only goes for multilingual individuals, and the vast majority of people in the world are polyglots. It is an exception in the United States, but in India, in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, in Europe, speaking 2, 3, 4, 5 languages is not an exception, is a way of simply being. I also mean this in the sense of monolingual. A person who speaks only one language, probably be that without being fully aware of it, is an individual that moves from one register to another. And so that person can speak a certain type of English, if English is the language we are talking about right now, with friends, that is different than with colleagues, that is different to the stream of consciousness that that individual might have. We change the syntax, the grammar, the morphology, the depending on the ecosystem that we move in. And the versatility, the malleability, the plasticity of the language or the languages is, I think, one of the most exciting features of reality. The capacity to see things that all of us are coinciding on from different perspectives through different ways of using words.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. You know, also, I've always been struck, I do speak I speak more than two languages, but, you know, more or less fluently two languages. And I'm always struck about how a language has a certain character that changes my own feeling about myself. Is that true for you as well?
Absolutely. I don't think that languages are objective. They are subjective. They are lenses through which we see things, or membranes through which we savor things. And the cadence, the music of a language, say French, is very different to Spanish or Portuguese or Swahili or Hebrew or Italian. And that difference is, of course, subjective in terms of the individuals. Some people might be born into French and have a longing for English because they see it as a second language or as a foreign language. Whereas for some of us, French would be the foreign language that we would be coming to. It is the sense of foreignness, or the arrival that we have to a language that is not our first one, or as the saying goes, our mother language, that gives us a different type of perspective. But I'll go a little further. I am, when I speak Spanish, I am aware that I'm moving my hands and making facial gestures in a way that I do very differently when I speak English or when I speak Hebrew. I think that the body is in tune to the language that we're speaking, and it functions as a calibrator, or as an emitter of a different type of the self, of who we are and how we're projecting it to others. But there's one added element that I think is important. Even though we say that we speak Spanish, or we speak French, or we speak whatever African or indigenous language, the fact is that through our journey in life, we come to those languages, and those languages come to us, and we change within those languages, change for us as well. And that means that, you know, the Spanish that I speak today is not the same that the Spanish that I spoke as a little boy, or the Spanish that I would speak in 10 years.
Yes, well, that's so interesting. And, you know, now we are talking here about American English in this wonderful book, The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language. We're a country of immigrants, of course, and you also immigrated to the U.S. You talk about the journey that turns the immigrant from an outsider into an insider. You call it a very American reinvention. And you say that American English, in many cases, is the result of choice. Tell us what you mean by this, turning outsiders into insiders, making that choice.
It is easy and maybe a commonplace, Francesca, to think that when somebody's arriving to the United States, is arriving to a new space, to a new geography, to a new terrain. That is what we all conceive, the default approach. We're moving spatially from one location to another. But the fact is that we are also doing other types of journeys. One is that we are moving, say, from India to the United States, from a type of understanding of time, of how time works in society, in life, in India, that is very different to the time that we see in the United States. When we immigrants arrive to the United States, we enter an accelerated way of approaching life, an ambitious, a forward-looking, a frantic, time-consuming, time-pushing path that is very much about time as a capital. We don't want to waste time. We want to be effective with the way we schedule our days, so on and so forth. Very different from many other parts of the world. That is at the level of seeing the immigrant journey in the time dimension. And then there is the language dimension. When we arrive to a new country like the United States, we're arriving to an ecosystem that is made of different words that many of us maybe never heard before, or only heard as a tourist language or as a second language or in whatever capacity. And now we are being thrown into that grammar, that syntax, the metabolism of the language. And I think immigration is the reinvention of the self in those new contexts, the spatial context, the time context, and the cultural linguistic context. When somebody arrives with Spanish, say from El Salvador or from Honduras to the United States, and within 10 years is now willy-nilly using English to communicate, there is a competition of different forms of identity in that person. And the English now has become the prevalent, the dominant one. And that means that there's a new mask or a new appearance or a new perception. That is also immigration. It's very much about a new birth. It could also be very traumatic. All immigrants go through a sense of loss, a sense of cutting an umbilical cord, not finding their roots in this place for quite some time because their roots were left in the past. And that results in even different ways of dreaming. I remember coming to the United States and being struck maybe about 5 or 7 years into my assimilation process of how different my dreams were when compared to the type of dreaming that I was having at home, and how uninteresting they were for many Americans. Whereas in Mexico, people would ask me, "What did you dream today? Tell us." Tell my mother would say, or my friends would say, the role of dreams in the grammar and the syntax of dreams. So I think that that immigration is at the very basic level about relocating spatially, but it is much more complex than that, much more essential, basic, you know, something that happens at the very God level. And in language is the way that gets expressed. Many of us immigrants get very frustrated, not because we don't know the ways, the ins and outs of the new society, but because we don't have the words to describe the ins and outs. It takes a while to be able to narrate our journey as immigrants. One thing is to become an immigrant. The other one is to be able to tell the story of what is happening to us and to find the right language to do that.
I'm curious, how did your dreams change?
My dreams changed in the texture, Francesca, in the color, and in the way people relate to them. You know, I have a brother who's a musician. And my brother says that, or at least he used to say, that his dreams are sound driven. He hears things in his dreams. I don't hear things in my dreams. I know that people are talking, but I don't know what language they are using in my dreams. I didn't know what language they were using in my dreams when I was in Mexico. And now that I'm in the United States and in the other parts of the world that I have lived in, I know that they are understanding each other. There's no subtitles. There's no dubbing in my dreams, but I don't hear them. And it's not, I'm not aware inside the dream that that this is a silent movie. It is as if this was just the way, because a silent movie is a movie that doesn't have something. It doesn't have sound. You're aware of that absence. Whereas in my dreams, I'm not aware of the absence of sound. It's just that life goes on like this. And I have, in the last few years, I'm 61 right now. In the last few years, I can say that I have been trying to recover, in some way, the type of dreams that I had when I was a younger person in Mexico, and kind of move them to the fore. It's not something that is done through one's conscience or voluntarily, but I feel a certain nostalgia for those dreams that I had in Mexico. And for the fact that in Mexico, I do remember people asking me constantly, so what did you dream today? And in what way does that connect with your life? As a daily, usual matter of relations, of relating to one another. Whereas here in the United States, I think dreams are much more private. People take them less seriously. It's just the garbage of the mind that occurs while you're not being conscious. But I think dreams are much more, and I'm not going in the direction of Freud, of trying to decode the dreams to find particular symbolism or the dream as a metaphor. It's just that the dream, I mean, we spend one third of our lives asleep. That one third cannot be that we're not awake. It's another world with its own language, with its own way of relating, instruments, artifacts, people to one another. And I think it's an important imaginative dimension. And I'm very interested in the languages of dreams.
Yes, and that contrast between the way we really don't pay much attention to dreams in this country and how they do in Mexico. Now, I want to talk and come back to the book, The People's Tongue. You provide a kind of history, a chronicle, through the words of the different contributors to this book. And it's really remarkable how English has changed so much since the beginning of colonization. In fact, you kind of liken it to it's not quite Middle English, but it is a little bit, it's certainly different than the English that we use today. So English has changed a lot since the beginning of colonization. Is that true for other languages? Have they changed as much as English has over the centuries? Or is there something unique about English that has allowed it to transform and expand so much?
Beautiful question. I will start my answer by saying that the one constant in the world in general, but certainly in language, is change. Change is the constant of the word bank that we have with us all the time. And though we, as I was mentioning before, we say that we speak English, the English that we're speaking today is different from the English that we spoke yesterday or that we will speak tomorrow. And it might sound ludicrous or facetious to suggest something like this, but new words are emerging constantly, every day, every minute, and words are dying too. They are being replaced. There are many words that our ancestors 450 years ago in the early days of colonization used that we no longer do, and many other words that we now have at our disposal. There are many more words in the world that there were 1,000 years ago and 2,000 years ago. That is the depository of language. Just to give you an example, Francesca, the Bible as a very complex book, has roughly 8,000 different words. I'm not saying that the Bible has a total of 8,000 words. It has many more, but it has a vocabulary of around 8,000 words. By the time Shakespeare comes around, his vocabulary, again, it's not the total number of words that Shakespeare uses, but the total number of different words that Shakespeare uses is around 16 to 18,000. And that has grown exponentially to the present because we need new words to describe new artifacts because we don't fully forget the old words, not many of them. We have dictionaries, historical dictionaries, that remind us how a word was used 700 years ago, 200 years ago. And we need more words because the world today is more complex, even if we resist describing it that way. Now, there are some languages that move faster than others. I would say that a language that is spoken by a small number of people in an area, in a geography of the world that has little contact with the outside world. I'm thinking, I don't know, the Amazon or somewhere in Asia or whatever, Alaska. The contact with the outside world, the contact of languages, it generates an infusion, a negotiation, a giving back and stealing from that expands the bank of a language. And colonial languages, imperial languages, meaning languages that have gone out of their boundaries into territories, are languages that have faced the fact that they need to absorb new words. And we were talking about immigrants, the amount of words that English has absorbed from immigrants that have come to this country, and the amount of words that English has absorbed from going to Vietnam, Cambodia, Iran, Iraq, Latin America. It's an ever-expanding database, so to speak. So English moves very fast. English is the lingua franca today, either we want it or not. It is, for every 5 speakers of English, 3 are non-native speakers, so there's a lot of pressure on the native speakers. The non-natives acquire the language somewhere in life, whereas the native speakers take it for granted. And the non-natives know what it means to speak another language because they came to English. They speak English in China, they speak English in Namibia, in Argentina. That's a very different approach than being born into English in Boston or in San Francisco or in whatever other part of this country. And because it moves so fast, it also changes so fast. It is, I think, dramatic to see in one lifetime how words get transformed. When I arrived to this country in 1985, the word bad, B-A-D, was beginning to change, but still meant something negative. And the word bad today has been utterly and completely transformed. The word day has been transformed, T-H-E-Y, the word woke, many words that were not around when I, just 40 years ago, when I first came, and other words that have gone out of use.
Yes, it's funny. I was just thinking of the word woke because the word woke just a few years ago was a positive thing. Of course, it still is in my mind. But there is a whole section of people in this country who evidently don't want to be awake, for whom it's a negative thing. And that is so ironic. But I guess my question was, is there something unique about American English? Because I think that's an important point, that English as a colonial language, whether it, is British English or American English, of course, expanded hugely because it exported itself to other countries, became a dominant tongue there, and then absorbed the tongue that was there. But you point out in this book, The People's Tongue, Ilan Stavins, you point out that other languages, including British English and, of course, French and Italian, have a kind of language, you know, they have institutionalized what is correct. They have set up, you know, there's the Académie Française to, you know, police the boundaries of French and to make sure that words are not included that would pollute the language. We don't have that in America. And yet, at the same time, we also don't have dialects. So in some way, there's a paradox. We are both more homogenized, but less policed. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Francesca, I think that in the age of a national conversation on police brutality, and that means the brutality of an authority force against the most vulnerable segments of our society, physically, that is, in terms of the body itself, the question of police brutality at the level of language is very different. Who uses the English language, and in what way do we brutalize the speech that we engage in vis-a-vis others? One of the aspects that absolutely intrigues me about this moment, and I would describe this moment as one defined by ideological fracture that can be lethal if we are not careful enough, is the alternative vocabularies that the left and the right use to describe what is happening right now. It is the same English language. We are brought together by this American English in this country of 330 million people. But at the same time, it is an American English that has been segmented, cut apart by very different lexicons that we use to describe each other, the favorite words of these different groups, I hate the term weaponized, but weaponizes that lexicon in order to describe the other as alien, as suspicious, as undermining of our own reality. And thus a word for one group like immigrant can feel empathetic, and another one, and for the other group, can feel threatening. The word political correctness for one group can be positive, and for the other one will be absolutely negative. Don't be politically correct, the right says. I don't know if there is a uniqueness to American English. Maybe its uniqueness is found in the fact that we are in it right now, and that it is the present, at present, the most decisive language in the world. But every language that achieves that level of sophistication and of power eventually declines, eventually is put aside, in spite of the fact that its speakers, call them Latin speakers or call them French speakers or call them Phoenician or Babylonian speakers, don't dare to believe that that power, that capital would ever come to an end. There's this pride, that this hubris in empire that English, American English, will be what it is forever and ever without any transformation. It is unlikely. Those are the cycles of language. Languages are born, they developed, they achieve adulthood. Some of them, they decline, and many of them die or reconfigure themselves. And it is absolutely unlikely that English will not go through, American English will not go through the same cycle, because it is a living organism. Now, I want to say something about this wonderful question that you asked about the authority within the language, as an academy, the Académie Française, or Academia de la Crusca in Italian, or La Real Academia Española. Yes, we don't have it. It's astonishing that such a magisterial language doesn't have an entity that legislates what is correct and what is incorrect. That shows that those other academies, the ones that I listed and many others, many standardized languages have an institution, government funded, that is endowed in charge of saying what is right and what is wrong. And many people don't pay attention to them. They're almost ridiculous in their presence, but they exist and they continue to be funded. We don't have one. We don't have anyone in Washington that is telling us, do not use the word bad in that way, or don't use the word woke in that way. We have dictionaries, and those dictionaries, the ones in the United States and the ones in English, are descriptive dictionaries. That is, they reflect the way the language is spoken on the street, in the kitchen, on the playground, in the classroom, but do not tell the kitchen or the playground or et cetera how to use the language. Other languages where there's such an academy have descriptive dictionaries, prescriptive dictionaries, which are dictionaries that tell people how to use the language. Again, I don't think that people pay much attention to them. In the Spanish-speaking world, every time the Academia, la Real Academia, announces that we can no longer use this accent or this word is no longer legitimate, people just laugh and go on using it. And yet, we use it at least for laughing. In the United States, we laugh at other things. That is why I think that English is such an interesting, American English in particular, such an interesting phenomenon. It is left to us to both create the language and to destroy it, to contain it and to push it out of its boundaries. We can't blame anybody else but ourselves. If the language, as John Adams once said, is going to the dogs, it is poorly shaped, or if the language can produce masterpieces, like Infinite Jest, or like the poems of Emily Dickinson, or the novels of Toni Morrison, it is up to us to do with it as we wish.
Elon Stabenz talking about his book, The People's Tongue. He'll be back after the break.
You know, Woody Guthrie got out of the hospital once and took his son Arlo, age 6, aside. He says, Arlo, they're singing my song. But they didn't put all the verses in the school songbooks. You gotta learn these verses. In the squares of the city, by the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. As they stood there hungry, I stood there whistling. What did he whistle?
The great Pete Seeger and audience singing This Land Is Your Land. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. We're spending the hour with scholar and writer Elon Stabenz, talking about his magnificent anthology of and about American English. It's called The People's Tongue. Just before the break, we were talking about how easily Americans create new words, change the meanings of words, and generally feel entitled to transform our language according to the needs and uses of the moment. Let's pick up where we left off. You know, I'm put in mind of the essay of H.L. Mencken, his discussion of the American character you include in the book, in this essay, because it links the two parts of the answer that you gave me just there. You know, he indicates the kind of, as you say, the anarchic, I don't think he uses that word, but, you know, the anarchic creation of language that Americans feel entitled to do. But then he goes on to say that the American is not lacking in a capacity for discipline. He submits to leadership readily and even to tyranny. But he prefers, and here I'm paraphrasing now, he prefers a new tyrant, not a traditional tyrant. He says, like, a new fallacy in politics spreads faster in the United States than anywhere else on earth. And I had to think that he was channeling our current situation. And so what struck me as you were talking before about woke and the divide in language between right and left, my experience has been that it is often the language of the left that the right then appropriates and twists around, turns from a positive to a negative, and renders it meaningless in its original meaning. It's an act of power that is taken over the creativity of other people who have said, you know, have used it in an original way. So they turn it around. And, you know, now we're thinking a lot about fascism. And so I kind of want to ask you about, you know, I remember Victor Klemperer in World War II wrote a book called The Language of the Third Reich. And in this kind of twisting of positive to negative, in this kind of assertion of power over what other people have created, do you see some of this? You know, is this some of the language of American fascism?
Your question is fascinating, and it pushes me, Francesca, to think on a number of different levels. On the one hand, it is indeed a statement. Mencken was an extraordinary thinker, a curmudgeon, and a very savvy journalist who understood very well that it is not only what we write about, but how we write about it that defines who we are. And I believe that his reflections on American English remain some of the most insightful at the level of a society that is defined by individualism, but obsessed with collectivism. We want always to make it as ourselves, to put our name out there, but we always have the longing, maybe the guilt, that we are living too many dead corpses along the way. And so we think of that effort to bring others along. It is that tension between the one and the many. But there's another dimension that is very important and it connects with the period of right now, the emergence of fascism, which only is not only happening in the United States. The arrival of the strong man in Turkey, in Hungary, in Venezuela, in the United States, in Italy, that is so significant and is a response to a kind of a lethargic liberalism that has run out of strategies of how to look at this late stage of the kind of capitalism that we have today. What do we the left, in what language do we engage in? Fascism, on the one hand, polishes the language, is very careful on what is forbidden, on what is censored, on what is canceled. And on the other hand, it uses a strategy, as you said, of appropriation. Nazism, for instance, or Stalinism, used the language of communism or used the language of liberalism to turn it around and make people feel that they were doing whatever Hitler or Stalin were telling them to do, not only for themselves, but for a higher collectivist goal. But I want to say something that strikes me as very important, Francesca. I think that the appropriation is not only from the right to the left. It's also from the left to the right in the United States. And it actually is a form of cannibalism that we depend on. My view is that American society moves forward by devouring what is in the margins and pushing it to the center. It happens with Black music or Latino music or certain fashion that comes. It starts by being used by the kids in the hood or the kids in certain parts of California turning the baseball cap back, the pants down, the baggy shirts, and eventually the drive for the new, this tyranny of wanting always to be different, pushes that fashion that was originally rebellious into the center, so that the people that are marginalized have to invent something new that will be co-opted yet again all the time by the fashion industry and others. And it happens the same thing with language. I think the language that we use today that is so astonishingly powerful for, say, spoken word poetry or the language of rap and hip hop has moved from the margins to the center and is much more accepted, but it started as a rebellious language. So appropriating the parlance of certain groups by the middle class or by those in power is a de facto mechanism that American culture uses in order to always feel that it's being in a state of renewal. And that is very clearly seen at the level of language. Words that were considered to be inappropriate at one point are words that everybody uses. Take the word fuck, a word that is among the most versatile and most often used in the language. Up until the 1970s, the dictionaries, the New Yorker, the Atlantic, would refuse to include this word because it was a negative, inappropriate word. Today, the word is everywhere, and it has lost its edge, yet it continues to be used, and we come up with other words in order to bring back an edge. And those words will move from the periphery to the center as well. So it's a stealing, it's a borrowing, it's a debt, it's an attempt to make us new by taking it away from those people that we consider to be dangerous, but we eventually become dangerous like them, or at least we pretend to become dangerous. By the time it gets to us, the danger has disappeared. Language is a perfect laboratory to see this.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Ilan Stavins about his anthology of and about American English. It's called The People's Tongue. Well, yes, and I just want to make a small point on this. I agree with you. On the other hand, there is something different, I think, in the right's appropriation of left words like woke or politically correct, because what they are meant to do is to turn them around specifically, and to deny them is to make a mockery of the original concept. And that's a little different than, you know, white middle class kids adopting rap, let's say, in the 1970s and 80s, which was more of an homage. Crude as it may have been, it was. But I want to move on a little bit to talk a little bit more about this book, The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language. And it goes back to this notion of what is acceptable, as we've been talking about, what's not acceptable language and how that changes. You include an excerpt from The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And, you know, I think I read Huck Finn back when I was in grade school. So I did not remember any of this. Mark Twain used the vernacular Black English. He also used the N-word. Yet it struck me that in the text, his use of that word is far from disrespectful of the character Jim. I mean, Jim is a fully realized character here. He's not really, I don't think he's a caricature. So could you talk a little bit about how meaning and context here is used in this section and what it tells us about, you know, the use of language of American English and difficult words in general?
I don't think Mark Twain, were he alive today and had just completed Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, would get his book published. I think that book would succumb to the culture and language wars that we are witnessing. He would be portrayed as an appropriationist, as demeaning a Black culture, as a not having the full complex experience of the Black slave, the runaway slave, in order to convey the complexity. I couldn't agree with you more. The character of Jim is extraordinarily complex, but not seen as complex through the prism of today's debacles on language, culture, and politics by many pundits. There have been attempts, as you know, to purge the book from the N-word because it is considered to be demeaning, not by Mark Twain in his time, but how the word is demeaning today. And in order for the book to be read in Alabama and in Mississippi, in the South in general, a book cannot include such a word, we are told. There have been editions of this most extraordinary of novels. I think, frankly, it's the best American novel ever written. And those editions do not include, have replaced one of them. I was very close to that controversy that happened 10, 15 years ago. It replaced the word, the N-word, with the word slave, totally changing the meaning. But it was the only way to get the book into the libraries at that time and into the classrooms in the South. And the argument that the editor, a very knowledgeable sage, a wise scholar, offered was, look, I'm not replacing the original. The original is available in dozens of other editions. I'm offering one way to get this book into those classrooms, into those libraries. And the curious student and teacher will eventually make their ways to the first edition or to the multiple other editions. Today, we have a debate that is not that similar 10, 15 years ago, or maybe 150 years ago, and that is that works by Ian Fleming, James Bond, and by Agatha Christie, and by Roald Dahl and others are being purged of words that are deemed to be inappropriate for today's sensibilities, and replaced with words that are much more bland and acceptable. Is this what we want to do with literature? We want to be cleansing it? I think it's utterly inappropriate. On the other hand, I believe that if it will get people to read a book, it eventually encourage them to go to the original. I'm not opposed because I don't believe that we are eliminating the source. You know, the Bible is one of the most violent books ever published. It is the character of God in the Hebrew Bible is as a vengeful, tyrannical, inhumane creator of the world. And if we ever want to expurgate the Bible of nasty parts in order to make this a character much more lovable, the way he becomes in the Christian Bible, I guess we will end up with probably 1/12 of the actual narrative. And if we want to do the same with Shakespeare, his five-act plays might be reduced to 2-scene plays because many of them are just overpacked with violence all over and with some words also that at that time were considered offensive. Language can be offensive. Language is meant to be offensive. It is not that the offense is made. It's that we have to be aware of what that offense is about. We have to contextualize it. We have to appreciate that we have at our disposal those very edgy words and that we're opting to use other words. But we can't cleanse the past. I don't believe that bringing down statues is the way to move forward. I think I'm much more in favor of understanding, of populating those statues in cities with other characters that will allow us to see how the past changes and the language changes as a result.
You know, as someone who's, I'm Jewish and I love Shakespeare, and I always have a frisson of uncomfortableness when I watch The Merchant of Venice, but I certainly wouldn't want it to be any other way.
Yes. You know, The Merchant of Venice, Francesca, is such an incredible play. I'm Jewish as well. I happen to think that Shylock is a character with whom Shakespeare identified. Even though, you know, he's not the Merchant of Venice, he's not the protagonist of the book. He shows up only in a few of the scenes of the book, but he steals the show, and he has some of the best lines in the book. He is not more unappealing than other characters in the book as well, but he's Jewish at a time when being Jewish was perceived to be dangerous, and he wants a pound of flesh from Antonio and so on. But he's an outsider, the way Shakespeare was an outsider also in his perception, in his religious view. And I think that if we decided not to stage The Merchant of Venice, or if we cut the parts we didn't like, there would be nothing left. I believe for Jews and non-Jews, it is important to stage the play in full in order to understand Shakespeare's time and to understand ours.
So in the few minutes that we have left, there's so many different strands, in a way, as we've pointed out here, as you pointed out in this book, The People's Tongue, Ilan Stavins, so many different strands of language that all kind of come together in one mighty stream in American English. I want to ask you, how do we honor, and I think that this is actually a question for our society as a whole, too, how do we honor and protect the distinct traditions, the distinct ethnicities, creating a multicultural quilt instead of a battleground?
The way to do it is by recognizing that we don't speak one language. We speak many American Englishes, and that the language of New York is not the language of Montana or the language of Louisiana or of Texas or California, and that the language of youth is not the language of people that are in their 60s or 70s, and that the same thing happens with different immigrant groups and different political groups in this country. We are 330 plus million people speaking 330 plus million different ways of American English. And that is only the present. There are many millions of people that have preceded us. The best way to approach this polyphonic language is by acknowledging that we are just vessels in its journey. The language travels, and it travels through us. The very same words that we use have been used in the past and will be used in the future in different ways, both past and future. We are just one snapshot, one moment in that journey. The journey of how those words, that syntax, keep themselves alive by getting transformed all the time. We have an incredible reservoir of possibilities in our language. And the best we can do with it is create beauty out of it, in poetry, in television shows, in sermons and speeches. It is not, again, only what we say, but how we said it. When Abraham Lincoln delivers the Gettysburg Address, 242 words alone. And yet those 242 words are some of the most precise, well-calibrated, sharp, in beautiful words in the English language. Those same words, if you dismantle the Gettysburg Address, throw the words in different directions, will create anything you want, even something ugly. But he managed to put them together just in the right way, in that speech that reverberates all through our minds and hearts because of that capacity to use the right word. That is what I'm trying to say. So many words we have, but finding the right word is the challenge. And the right word for you will be different than the right word for me. As long as it's the right word, it's a word that matters, it's a word that expresses who we are, and that doesn't negate the person that is in front of us. But by listening to what we're saying, or by listening to what others are saying, we appreciate that the words they use are equally musical, I think that we will be honoring the language that way. There are no broken languages. There are not perfect languages either. There's no pure language. All languages are impure. All languages are in the process of gestation. We are the creators. We are also the witnesses. It's up to us.
And let's not forget that that Gettysburg Address was meant to unify our nation, as I think is the central point in many ways of this wonderful book, The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language. Ilan Stavins, it's just been so delightful to talk with you about this book.
It has been wonderful. Thank you for your savvy and precise and very timely questions. And I hope that I hope readers will go to the book and find in it what they may and create with it the entries that the book still wants as the language travels.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you again.
My pleasure. Be well.
In addition to The People's Tongue, Ilan Stavins is the author of many other books and anthologies. He's professor of humanities, Latin American, and Latino culture at Amherst College. Let's go out on a dialogue that's featured in The People's Tongue. It's a clip from the classic Abbott and Costello skit, Who's on First? That was the baseball sketch in Abbott and Costello's 1945 film, The Naughty 90s.
Strange may seem they give ball players nowadays very peculiar names.
Funny names?
Nicknames, pet names.
Not as funny as my name, Sebastian Dinwiddie.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Funnier than that?
Oh, absolutely. Whee! Yes. Now, on the St. Louis team, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
That's what I want to find out. I want you to tell me the names of the fellas on the St. Louis team.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
Do you know the fellas' names?
Yes.
Well, then who's playing first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The fellow playing first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first base.
Who is on first?
Have you got a first baseman on first?
Certainly.
Then who's playing first?
Absolutely.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Why not? The man's entitled to it.
Who is?
Yes.
So who gets it?
Why shouldn't he? Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. After all, the man earns it.
Who does?
Absolutely.
Well, all I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no. What is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Now, take it easy.
What's the guy's name on first base?
What's the guy's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking about him.
How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
Stay off of first, will you?
Well, what do you want me to do?
Now, what's the guy's name on third base?
Well, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again.
Well, I can't change their names.
Will you please stay on third base, Mr. Broadhurst?
Please, now, what is it you want to know?
What is the fella's name on third base?
What is the fella's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know. Third base.
The great Abbott and Costello in Who's on First? That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.